gigabyte, kilobyte, terabyte, megabyte, all this stuff makes my brain mega hurts. Fortunately, someone is available to explain all this technobabble. Guiding you on your computer quest, here is Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
Just some of what we've got coming up here in this hour of Computer Talk Radio. Keith M. Zedor and I are going to talk about the experience of communicating technology to non-techies. I'm going to cover the fake IT support remote access breach. And I'm going to note that everything is vying for our attention to our very own detriment. Of course, that's just some of what's coming up in this hour and some of what's on this week's Computer Talk Radio. If you miss any of it, of course, you can check out the podcast at computertalkradio.com. That's computertalkradio.com. You can also reach out to us with your computer questions, your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Scroll down where it says contact us today, and I will get back with you. If you'd prefer to leave a voicemail for me, you may do that as well at 888-NERD-888. That's 888-637-3888. I'm here to help you, inform you, communicate with you, and bring technology to a different level for you. So let's dive into the news from this past week. And it's actually a little bit more than that. But Mark Zuckerberg recently admitted that Meta's AI plans, along with cutting 8,000 employees, oh, is that all? It wasn't going as well as he had hoped. In the aftermath, Meta shares are down, morale is tanking, and there is the blind hope that AI would cover those jobs. But that hasn't panned out at all for him. This echoes the experience of others, as we've noted weeks ago, who noted that shifting dollars from workers to AI is a shell game. It gives zero return on investment, and it, yes, as he discovered, kills morale. It seems that the human equation is what is actually needed, even in an AI world, and this was a hard lesson for Mark Zuckerberg. Are the other C-suite executives in other companies going to heed this warning, this alarm? That's a bigger question, and I don't know. We've been watching this, and I've been hearing a lot of shifting, a lot of rumbling, and maybe things are going to get better. We can only hope. Now, the late Gene Wilder brought Willy Wonka to the big screen with an amazing performance. And you're wondering, why does this have to do with computers and technology and all of that? Well, this fall, a new reality show appears to be pushing forward in a mimicry of the famous contest for money instead of control of an established chocolate empire. And the Netflix show has trailers out right now. You can go online. You can check out these trailers. But be forewarned. You see, they've captured Gene Wilder's actual voice with permission from his family, but none of the chaotic charm of the original, making it more of a mockery than an honor to such a versatile and brilliant actor. This underscores the recurring theme that I've been presenting here over recent years about how AI may seem like the real thing, but it can't deliver on human qualities and performance and abilities like we can. You know, the real humans, the actual people that helped build all of this. Now, I'm not a fan of GoDaddy. You've heard of them, and there's reasons why I'm not a fan of them. They appeal to a certain crowd that I don't agree with. Anyways, sometimes you will still agree with folks you don't like, and this is all about that. See, GoDaddy has drawn attention to an order from India that could thrash some of what we hold important on the internet. The Delhi High Court has issued massive measures regarding how we can register domain names. All right, specifically, domain sellers can no longer offer free privacy protections by default. They must hand over contact details to anyone with a, quote, legitimate interest within 72 hours and bar any address that is a variation on a protected brand name. Now, I can agree a little bit with the last of those, but even that can fall apart. Yes, scammers operate in that realm, but think of McDonald's, okay? There are people who are named McDonald. That's their last name. It's a very common surname. And there are all kinds of different words out there that people have put trademarks and patents on, and they are very close to real words. So is a real word going to be banned? Is this going to all fall apart? Yeah. Now, those other two, those are specifically against existing laws that protect privacy by requiring default privacy directions. And this is both in the EU, but even in India itself, this is really a confusing ruling altogether. The information that is buffered through privacy protections can be important to individuals who don't want bad actors to have personal information, or people who simply don't want their home address out there on the internet for all to see. And who decides what a legitimate interest is? And the idea of turning all of these requests around within 72 hours? Yeah, fortunately, there is an appeals court off in India who's going to decide next steps this coming week. Hopefully, it stops there. Now, California had something called Protect Our Games Act, and I covered this, I don't know, I think about a month or so ago, and it seems it's failed to leave the Senate committee. It passed the House overwhelmingly, 43-16, I think is what the number was, but it had to go through a committee in the Senate, and the Senate said, the committee itself, it just, what? No. Now, that's not to say that we're out of the water on this, but it does mean that this whole idea is stalled out. The more that I saw of this, the more that I was concerned, as it lacked some of the answers that you and I need about how it would protect our gaming investments, as well as how it might affect some of the smaller players in the gaming industry. Now, I've said it before, but politicians are not tech savvy, and some of the authorship of this bill made it quite apparent. Now, I'm not fond of how the opposition, the Entertainment Software Alliance, they brought some bad ideas forward. They said, okay, it's going to impact this, and it's going to cause this and that and all of this. And there was some really odd things that they put forward. But the key thing for me is that it has stopped, and that is what I have to hold solace in. It's not, these were not good arguments by the ESA, but at least it's stalled out. Now, there is a new CAPTCHA test to see if you're human, and it's coming, and it's being tested by Google right now. You're familiar with CAPTCHA. It's the whole thing of proving that you are a human. This new approach is having you turn on your webcam, and you're going to wave or perform other actions with your hand. The webcam will track your various knuckle movements and stuff like that. But this reeks of other identity theft issues, with a suspicion that they might pick up enough of your fingerprint to identify you. Google says none of the data is going to be associated with you, and all of the videos, all of the tracking is going to be deleted. But then they also note that all of the data collected is handled according to Google privacy policies, which, frankly, are rather vague and wanting for protection of us, our privacy, and our personal lives. My best suggestion for everybody out there, just move on, hit the bypass, say, I want to do the whole identify all pictures with motorcycles or whatever it is, and you're going to need to do this for as long as you can. Coming up next on Computer Talk Radio, everything is vying for attention to our very own detriment.
Let's talk about on and off.
You mean like light switches?
Yeah, the original user interface device.
And you were there, right?
Hey, I'm not that old.
Yeah, you are. So on and off.
Yeah, only with no humans doing it, like...
But you and I both have our computers on CyberPower UPS systems.
Yeah, so we have power, but there's another on and off.
Oh, right. Online and offline.
You got it. Meaning another UPS at the cable modem and VoIP phone and Wi-Fi router.
And even a low-cost standby UPS can handle those. Better, of course, if it has AVR.
Right, so it doesn't have to hit the battery just because the line voltage drops.
Maybe it's a good time to mention the promo that saves $10 to $15. Details are at the CyberPower website.
And maybe you could put it on your website?
Oh, that's already done at computertalkradio.com.
You know, on and off, you take really good care of your listeners.
The phone number, 888-NERD, 888, that's 888-6373, 888. I want to talk for a moment about a battle that is going on for our attention and how tech companies are designing distractions into every single thing we do. Over the past decade, maybe less, maybe a little bit more, we have seen all of our interactions shift from tools we use to environments that we're living inside. Every app, every service, every platform out there is now competing for one very singular limited resource, your attention. And because attention translates directly into revenue, this whole design of modern technology has quietly evolved to keep us engaged far longer than we intend. This first layer in this battle shows up in the smallest interactions. Notifications aren't just reminders. They have become engineered interruptions. The timing, the color, the placement, they're all tuned to pull us back into that app. Yes, you can think about Facebook, but this is across the board, across a lot of others. This next one, too. The moment we open the screen, the interface is designed to keep us there. We get infinite scroll, autoplay, and algorithmic feeds that refresh faster than we can process. And I'm not just talking about Facebook. There's a few news sites that I use where they stack news articles beyond news articles beyond news articles. And if you just keep scrolling, you'll see new headlines that are all fashioned to draw you in. And these features aren't accidents. These are deliberate choices shaped by years of behavioral research. The next layer is how platforms personalize that distraction. Algorithms have long been learning what captures our attention. They feed us more of whatever it is that they think can hold us, even if it's not what we originally came for. The system will adapt to our habits with remarkable precision. And because the feed is tailored to our impulses that they've detected, it becomes harder to step away. The content feels relevant, even when it's not meaningful. And this all creates a loop, a personalized loop where the platform becomes the default destination whenever we're bored or stressed or we simply don't want to do a task. Even productivity apps are now using engagement tactics. I'm thinking of one particular app that is all about teaching you a foreign language, and they give you badges and streaks and nudges, and they want to keep us interacting. The line between helpful design and habit-forming design gets thinner every year. And then there's the cost we pay without noticing. Constant micro-interruptions break our focus. They make tasks take longer and feel more draining. That mental tax on our brains just adds up so quietly. And when our attention is fragmented, we lose the ability to sink into deeper work or meaningful rest. the day becomes a series of just all kinds of partial thoughts. And we may get an idea in our head, hey, I need to go research this, and we lose it a moment later. Oh, I need to go tackle this particular project. Oh, what was I thinking about? And all of a sudden, everything just falls apart. Even our leisure time gets affected because the same apps that entertain us also compete for our attention with an intensity that we were never really meant to go through. This, over time, creates this sense of restlessness, a feeling that we should check our devices even when nothing important is happening. And it becomes a habit long before we recognize it. All of a sudden, we keep checking. Oh, hey, I need to check Facebook. I haven't done that in a few hours. I need to check Facebook. I haven't done that in an hour. I need to check Facebook. I haven't done that in 30 minutes. Wait, what? Yes, it's a habit. And we need to be breaking this. We need to be reclaiming control. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't want us to reject technology. I don't want us to put aside all of this stuff. But these tech companies out there, they're designing for engagement because that's how their business model works. Understanding that can give us some better leverage. When we recognize these patterns, the nudges, the loops, the engineered friction, we can choose when to participate and when to step back. One of the biggest things I have done, and I continue to do, and we all need to do, is really make a change. We need to go through and disable non-essential notifications. We need to start looking at, do I really need to be hearing from Facebook every time somebody posts? No, we don't. Let's remove that notification. Do we need to be hearing from our news app when something small happens? No. I for whatever crazy reason, some celebrity dies, and I'm not talking real celebrity, some obscure person who is in one episode of Star Trek The Next Generation and has nothing else on IMDb, they pass away. Sorry. All of a sudden, I'm getting a news alert. Star Trek legendary actor. Wait, no. I don't know why I'm getting that, but I am. So I've been just setting those away, just removing some of these different things. If I get spam, which that kind of is, it's something we don't want, I disable that notification. I can also, and I do, use focus modes. And a focus mode can restore more control than you might expect. You set it up, you say, this is what I'm going to allow, this is what I'm not going to allow. And it starts to screen things down. We all need to start using all of these tools intentionally, not reactively. We need to be thinking about, I'm only going to go on Facebook at the end of the day. Not on my break, not at lunchtime, at the end of my work day. I'm going to get all of my work out of the way. That's just one example. You can do it in a number of different directions. But if you set the framework, you set the rules, this gives you some distinct power. The technology becomes an asset instead of this constant pull away from whatever it is that's going on in your life. And I'm not saying unplug. Your goal should not be to disconnect completely. It should be to use your devices, your software, your websites, whatever it is you're dealing with, on your terms, not on somebody else's, who wants to make money off of every single one of those terms. In the end, the battle for attention isn't about resisting technology. It's about remembering that your time, your focus, all of that is valuable. And you should be, you get to, you should be choosing where you want that time and focus to go. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. MicroCenter is where tomorrow's tech meets today's hands-on excitement. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I've been shopping Micro Center for years because they always have what's next. Whether you're building a custom desktop, upgrading your laptop, or diving into smart home automation, Micro Center has the gear, the guidance, and the grit to get you there. From high-performance laptops and ultra-fast storage to 3D printers, robotics kits, and pro-grade monitors, it's all under one roof. Need help? Their in-store experts speak your language, whether that's HDMI, USB-C, or I just want it to work. With over 20 locations nationwide and microcenter.com open 24/7, you're never far from your next breakthrough. Whether you're a weekend tinkerer, a creative pro, or just tech curious, Microcenter is your launchpad. Visit microcenter.com today. That's Microcenter, built for what's next. Microcenter.com. The phone number, 888-NERD-888. That's 888-6373-888. If I don't answer, that's okay. Leave a message, and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns. You can call anytime. Keith M. Sedor joins me now. And Keith, you and I both have been in IT for, we'll just say, a long time.
A dog's age.
More than that. But one of the things that we both have had to deal with, and we've done this with family, but also friends, and most importantly with clients, we have to translate tech over to non-techies.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to kind of bounce back and forth. One of the things, what is the trick you use in your mind to keep you calm and patient, and yet also relate this information to folks?
Well, I'm going to answer you a couple of ways. I'm going to take a short little detour to get there. I just was brought in by the guidance counselor from the middle school that my daughter used to go to. My daughter is in high school now, and I've had such a positive experience for their career day that the guidance counselor, even though I no longer have a child in that school, said, "Would you come back again? They really liked you and they want you to come back."
Okay.
I said, "Sure." So I've had a really positive experience, but I've done it in both the elementary school level and the middle school level.
Yeah.
And I have a totally different tack. Like when I talk to the elementary school kids, I'm talking to them about the nuts and the bolts of the computer, how it works, mechanics of it, and things like that.
Yeah.
But when you get people who are just about to go into high school and they want to know, what do you do as an Apple certified consultant? And I said, I'm going to share some information with you that has nothing to do with whether or not you choose to be an Apple consultant or a consultant of any kind. At the end of the day, you are providing somebody with a service based upon your level of expertise. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you become an architect. I don't care if you become an attorney or a doctor or a computer consultant. I said, what you're going to experience is you're going to be connecting with people, communicating with people, talking with people who do not have the same level of expertise, knowledge, and experience with the topic that you have. And you are going to need to be able to speak to them in a manner in which they not only don't feel condescended to, but they understand the information that you're attempting to convey to them. Otherwise, don't even bother.
Mm-hmm. So you're approaching it from a customer service perspective, which is very interesting, because so in my background, I do the same thing, but in the other direction.
Tell me what you mean.
So back when I started, I had to learn all of this stuff on my own. I had to go through and read books and magazine articles, and I had to reach out to folks and ask them questions. But I keep in my mind what was that like? What would I have hoped for somebody to tell me or share me the information? How can someone tell me how to do this? And I keep that frame of reference. So I think of it from the standpoint of being the consumer, customer, whatever you want to call it.
Absolutely.
And then I treat those people as I would have wanted somebody to have done for me.
And I'm going to expand upon to your point, because the way I look at it, Benjamin, we as human beings, we are all ignorant about something. There's something that you are expert in that I'm going to come to you one day and ask you questions about. And I'm not going to want to make you, I don't want you to make me feel stupid for having the questions.
Right.
Conversely,
yes.
When somebody comes to me because they're looking for me to give them information, I don't want to make them feel stupid. I want to make them feel confident that getting information from me to help them was a positive experience.
Now, I'm going to leave myself vulnerable here. Over the years, because we've known each other for well over a decade now, You've gotten tech advice from me, and I adapt it to some extent. When I do this, I know that I treat you as a fellow peer in the tech industry, But I want you to think about, like I gave you some advice on a Synology NAS, how to configure that for one of your clients. Mm-hmm. And there was a Windows system somewhere along the way, a couple of them over the years, where you've asked me questions. What is your feedback to me on advice like that I've given?
I think it is very sound advice, but I'll explain to you why I think it's sound advice. I work with a lot of people who are retired, and that is people who are well beyond our age of Gen X age group, Benjamin. And what I have to do in order to make sure that my information not only is received well, but also that they like me and they want to come back and spend more money with me as a consultant, it's not condescending them. So the way I do that is I approach any information I'm going to share with them with a certain understanding. And the understanding is that a lot of the older folks I'm talking to got through their entire working career with no more technology than an electric typewriter, an AM radio, a black and white TV, and a rotary telephone. And the card catalog at the local library was their version of Google. They wanted to do research. They literally had to go to a certain building downtown and look through a piece of furniture with index cards in it.
Yeah.
And If I can approach any information I'm sharing with them with that baseline, then I find that I have much greater success in conveying that information to them.
So you're saying I treated you like an old geezer?
We'll leave that conversation for another day, Benjamin.
So I think you're right. This is something that I always put myself in the shoes as best I can with whoever I'm talking with. One of the other things I freaking will do is I will check in with them, and it's does that make sense? Because I tell them usually after saying that once or twice, I'll remember I need to check in. I need to make sure they understand I'm trying to translate a bunch of stuff in my head to their level, and I want to make sure I'm coming across. It's not that I have any fear that they're having a problem with understanding. It's a matter of Am I having a problem with communicating?
Yeah, there doesn't have to be a rush in conveying the information.
Right.
If you take a moment to be thoughtful, to be introspective, to really look at the fact that you're giving a measured answer, not just rattling something. I mean, I remember the very first time I was at the Apple Genius Bar, and I wondered if, being that level of a technical guide for somebody was a skill that I possessed. I remember thinking that I smoked these guys because my level of technical knowledge was on par with theirs, but their communication skills, left a lot to be desired. I mean, I watched this one woman speak to an older gentleman like she was just reciting something off the back of her head and without really looking like she was giving an individualized, contextualized answer to his specific inquiry.
That's a tricky thing. We can't just recite things. We can't just read back the company manual. If that were the case, here, take the company manual, read this.
That's why they don't print manuals anymore.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, man. Just all kinds of interesting experience here. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And I'm Keith M. Seeger.
You are listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Most of us use digital cameras nowadays, but what do we do with those old pictures and slides in the back of the closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. If you have boxes of old slides, then you know they fade more and more each year. Let Legacy Digital scan them for you and stop the aging process dead in its tracks. You'll get beautiful 10-megapixel digital files, color-corrected and ready for printing. All this is done faster and cheaper than buying a film scanner and doing it yourself. Your files are then burned onto gold archival DVD discs where they will last for generations. Call right now, mention my name, Benjamin Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY. And tell them Benjamin sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
The phone number, 888-NERD, 888, that's 888-6373, 888. If I don't answer the phone, that's okay. Leave a message, and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions, your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Marty Winston joins me now, and Marty, one of the things that I've been exploring is moving into docking stations. And I understand you've got a nice one there.
Oh, I've got a sweetie. And this one's from Anchor. Listen, not all the docks I review are from Anchor.
Okay, yes.
The next one I review, or you're likely to hear anyway, is not from Anchor.
Yes.
However, respect for this baby. This is the Anchor Thunderbolt 5 E14-in-1 8K video Supreme Performance Multifunction Dock.
Supreme Performance all right.
Hey, probably translates better if, you know. What do? You have a Supreme Performance? Yes, with Diana Ross.
A little musical joke there. So
yes, ask your grandma.
Yes, 14 different things. Okay, so this is, I'm sitting down. Let's figure out what all does this have.
Okay, we'll deal with the list. Now, Thunderbolt 5, as you know, can daisy chain.
Yes, and it also is backwards compatible. So if you've got like a Thunderbolt 4 item or something
or USB 4.
Yeah. Yes.
So. Or USB 3 in some cases, although you're wasting a lot of bandwidth.
Yes.
This has, and I'm just going to go left to right as if you're holding it and turning it around.
Yes.
An SD or TF card slot.
Okay.
An audio jack. A power button, which is not a port. On this side, two USB-C 10 gig connectors.
Okay.
One USB-A 10 gig connectors. My old USB-A cables wouldn't handle 10 gig.
No, that is a tricky one. Well, I guess USB 3, if you're plugging in USB 3 sticks into there, that'll get up there.
That would be good for that. And now let's deal with the upstreams and downstreams. It's got one Thunderbolt 5 upstream port.
Okay.
And two Thunderbolt 5 downstream ports.
Okay.
You want to just take your computer and make it feed to other computers? You could start a network all day with this.
Sure, sure. Or there's plenty of drives out there that'll go into the Thunderbolt.
Yeah, or displays.
Yes, yes, definitely.
And speaking of displays, it's got DisplayPort 2.1. It's got HDMI 2.1.
Yes.
By the way, this side has two additional USB-A 10 gig ports.
Okay.
And I like this. 2.5 gig Ethernet port.
Okay, nice.
Now, your cable provider is probably not giving you a 2.5 gig modem for Ethernet.
Correct, yes.
But that doesn't mean you don't have stuff in the house that can handle, or the office that can handle 2.5 gig.
Right. And that's kind of a story that's going back quite a ways. I mean, I recall, you know, we would get maybe 10, 15, 20 megabit. And yeah. But then in-house, I would have 100 megabit.
So transfers among systems, you're sending it to a printer.
Sure,
you've got external storage, those things.
Yes.
It gets nuts and wonderful. And how many drives, never mind drives, how many displays do you run at once?
How many? Okay. So I do run just one display, but it's a 43-inch LG TV, which I find works quite well for my needs.
It does. But how many guys have 2, 4, 6 displays?
Oh yes.
How many of those are 4K displays?
For mine, both of those both of the ones I use here are 4K displays.
And there's the point. You need bandwidth to get resolution.
Yes, indeed.
And Thunderbolt 5 is brilliant at giving you lots of bandwidth, your ability to support another display just by plugging it in.
Yes, yeah.
Those I love that has finally left Never Never Land.
We're able to get that stuff now. Yeah.
So for people who don't always want to work with the notebook screen,
yeah,
who may not think a 2K display is quite enough,
mm-hmm.
who may have eyes that are no longer teenage years.
Yeah, yeah.
there's a lot about Thunderbolt that makes it a high priority for me. Thunderbolt 5 is the latest I can get. Hey, if 6 is out there, get in touch with me.
I have no idea how far off we are for Thunderbolt 6. It's inevitable. It's just like, we're going to eventually wind up with USB 14 and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. What number is the iPhone on now?
I don't know. 18? 19? somewhere in there. I'm still running a 14. But, there's only so much resolution I can get out of the camera
that true enough. Yeah, that especially on that, what, quarter megapixel display on the phone?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. So, again, Anchor 14-in-1 Supreme Performance. All right.
Yeah, 120 gig max data rate.
Okay. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and just a normal person. Recently, though, it was clear to me that it was time to upgrade. But I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After searching around for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when a 32-ounce soda would do. These guys know WordPress, Joomla, and regular standard websites. These guys at SiteGround are awesome. SiteGround.com. Site, SiteGround.com. bad guys are out to get us. They're out to get you, me, and everybody they can. And this one is related to the workplace. And it starts with this calm, professional-sounding phone call from someone who says, "Hey, I'm calling from the IT department. We've got unusual activity on your device, and we need to take a quick look." So this feels routine. It's the kind of thing that happens in any business workplace. The person who's calling you may have the right terminology, the right tones, and just enough internal detail to sound legitimate. They may reference your department, your manager, a recent software update, all kinds of things like this. And each detail is chosen to make you believe you're talking to someone on the inside. The fake IT support remote access breach is designed to make you compromise your own device without even realizing it. The attacker doesn't break in through a vulnerability. They walk in through your trust. That shift is what makes this so dangerous. The caller claims your device is showing signs of malware or unauthorized access, and oh, we've got to run a diagnostic. This is a quick fix to keep you working. That framing right there makes this request feel like it's helping you rather than something suspicious. Oh, now we've got to have you install this remote access tool, and or maybe it's a security scanner or whatever it is that's supposedly allowing them to investigate the issue. The software looks legitimate. It's got clean branding and reassuring language. It's designed to feel like something someone on a real IT team would use. However, once installed, the tool gives the attacker full visibility into your system. That's where they can browse files, they can capture keystrokes, they can install additional software, we call them payloads in the industry, without your knowledge. The entire compromise happens under the guise of helping you. Sometimes they're going to escalate this further. They may ask you to disable security settings or approve pop-ups that look like routine permissions. Each of these steps is framed as necessary to complete the diagnostic. And that slow erosion of caution is just part of the design. This really works because real IT teams do sometimes call employees. And remote access tools are genuinely used in support work. The attackers hide inside that blending of the truth and adding in their additional requests into the noise of everyday tech support. That familiarity portion becomes the camouflage. Real IT departments aren't going to ask employees these days to install unapproved software from a link in a call, and they're never going to request remote access without some level of prior authentication and verification. They follow strict procedures to confirm identity on both sides of the conversation. Those procedures exist for a reason. If you ever receive a call like this, hang up and contact your IT team through an official channel, not any number that they provide on the phone to you, the caller provides to you. This simple step will break the attacker's script. It puts you back in control of the conversation and the device. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Coming up next is a really funny guy. You all know him. Let's give it up for Alonzo Bowden. Alonzo!
So my uncle calls and he says he's dizzy and he's losing his balance. I'm like, "Unc, you want me to take you to a doctor?" He's like, "No, I'm going to look up the symptoms." I said, "Your symptoms are you're dizzy and you're losing your balance." So he said, "I can't get on the internet because my arm is numb." I said, "Well, use your good arm and dial 911. Stroke's no joke. If you or someone you love is showing symptoms of stroke, don't call family, don't dial a friend, don't wait because it might be too late. Dial 911. Time lost is brain lost. Seriously, dial 911.
Learn all the symptoms of a stroke at strokesnojoke.org. That's strokesnojoke.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
He makes computers seem easy, but that pocket protector says otherwise. Translating technobabble to English, your translation expert, Benjamin Rockwell, is here with Computer Talk Radio.
All right, we'll start off with the website, computertalkradio.com, computertalkradio.com. Of course, there's a bunch of stuff there. We put the news up there that I cover almost every week. We put up the podcast, and you can also reach out to me there. Just scroll down to where it says contact us today and fill it out. Give me all kinds of details. Of course, you can always phone me as well at 888-NERD, 888. That's 888-6373-888. Steve Keske joins me now. And Steve, what do you have for us this week?
As you know, I'm blind as a bat.
Okay, yes.
So, you know, I was looking around and I happened to notice that there are now, we have talked before about application programs.
Yes.
That have voice modules.
Okay. Refresh my memory. Are we talking like the
Microsoft Office
feeding out voices to you, like text to speech or speech to text? Or okay, all right,
both ways. All right. And now I understand that that certain operating systems have the same deal.
Yes, so I know it's been built into Windows. I know it's in 11. I know it's in 10. I want to say it goes back through Windows, probably even back to XP. I'm doing this completely from memory. It's been a while that you can do text to speech.
Right.
Speech to text, probably Windows 10 was when it got solid. It is quite able to recognize whatever it is that you're dealing with.
Well, that's true. And I've been using what they called OCR programs for a while. That's optical character readers.
Recognition, yes.
Recognition. And putting what you see in a image text into text so that you can listen to it.
Yes.
Hear it?
Yes.
And store it that way.
Yeah. Well, we're now at the point where the smartphones have, whether it's built in or in some of the various applications, they have for a while allowed you to take a picture and it would recognize the text within it, or you just basically use the camera.
Yeah.
And AI has moved that to a brand new level where it's no longer even just OCR, but you take a picture of something and it goes, oh, you just took a picture of an apple. You just took a picture of a sports car, whatever, you know, Ferrari. And it starts, they're getting really good with this.
Does the AI go brum, brum, brum when it's a Ferrari?
I haven't really dived deep enough to tell you the answer one way or another on that one. It is quite possible that you might program it to say, you know, somehow say, look, if I take a picture of a car, go vroom, vroom, vroom. If I take a picture of food, go chomp, chomp, chomp.
Yeah.
Or whatever. I don't know that anybody has gone that route.
You know, these weird people, you know, like me.
Sure.
Who really do like to push the envelope.
Yes.
On all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So have you been experimenting around with that? Have you done a whole lot of that kind of stuff? Or
no, I haven't experimented with it yet, but and other than the application side.
Yeah.
And some of it is very, very easy to use. Some of it's not.
Yeah. So I just looked up, and Windows Vista back in 2006 was when they did Windows speech recognition. Yeah. Although at that time it was not quite ready for prime time. As a matter of fact, some of the features within Vista were just not ready for us. It wasn't until we moved on to the next version where it started to solidify. And but that is really indicative of most of the different things that are out there within all of these operating systems these days. Apple had their big, huge, promised upgrade to Siri a couple of years ago, and it was not as good as they had said. And Apple Intelligence, and it wasn't as good as they said. Now, with this past week, they've announced yet again, oh, we're going to improve it. It's going to be the best thing since sliced bread. And Keith and I talked about that in another hour of Computer Talk Radio. But, you know, it hasn't been delivered yet. It isn't here yet. So we can't really even say that it is better than even unsliced bread. So who knows?
Yep. But the idea of these software companies doing more and more for people who have disabilities is always encouraging.
Yes, there is that. I do like when they do that because there's a bigger implication than just that particular small subset of users, yep, the people who are blind or deaf or whatever. There is a deeper implication because we can add in that capability, and a lot of people outside of the disability community take advantage of that. They go, hey, I found this plastic part here. Maybe the recognition will pick it up and go, oh, that's the exhaust cover for a 2020 Ford Explorer, whatever. We're moving in that direction, and we're getting a lot more enablement in that direction in a number of different ways, and that is exciting for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And the more we have this whole idea of working toward software being available and usable by people with disabilities, the rest of the community actually has better capabilities as well.
Yes. It is time and time again, the more we start going down these roads, you're absolutely right. It is going to make everybody's life better.
Yeah. And I remember back when Microsoft was saying, well, we just build this for, you know, good computer users. And I'm saying, but what about all the rest of us?
This is something that Microsoft, and you and I have talked about this off air. Microsoft goes through these phases. And sometimes they listen to the users, and sometimes they listen to themselves.
Yes.
And really the best thing to do is always listen to the customer. Always pay attention. And Apple has started to do a little bit of this over the recent years.
Oh, yeah. Back when I was a programmer, I always just say, when you want to design a system, the first thing you do is you sit down with the users and say, what do you want on the screen?
Yes. Yes. I've been there. I've done that. And learned a lot about businesses and how they operate through doing the user requirements and going, we can do that. Let me understand this a little bit more and so forth and so on. Oh, this is something we could go on for a long time on. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Steve Keske. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. You have a couple of those new carbon open frame racks from CyberPower, right?
Yeah, I love them. I configured a 25U to 40 inches deep, about twice as deep as a regular rack, and put more than a dozen peripherals in it.
Yeah, I saw your article about it. I can't believe it's not clutter.
And my 45U carbon rack, that's also 40 inches deep, will hold a ton of networking and control systems, the network video recorder.
Holy screwdriver, rack man!
You're getting one of their gorgeous enclosed racks soon.
Oh yeah, the 24U. Bigger than their wall mount carbon racks, but smaller than their tall boy.
Did you see what's happening with carbon on the CyberPower website?
Oh yeah, the promo, 10% off all their racks and rack accessories through the end of September. I put a link up at computertalkradio.com. computertalkradio.com. The phone number, 888-NERD, 888, that's 888-6373, 888. If I don't answer, that's okay. You can call me anytime, but leave a message and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Dr. Doreen Galley joins me now, and this is this next topic. I'm going to throw something at you, which is kind of funny. I'm sitting in a class just about 6 months ago, and I was sitting there, and the guy was talking about how sometimes we know stuff and sometimes there are people out there that don't know things. And he goes, how many people know about the Dunning-Kruger effect? And I raised my hand, and he points to me and he goes, give me the definition. And I kind of, at the moment, proved it because my brain just went and just froze. And I couldn't remember. I knew what it was, but I couldn't remember it for that 30 hours that he kept looking at me for answering it.
That's funny. So, yes, the Dunning-Kruger effect is when people who know the least about a topic are the most confident about their knowledge, which they don't have, in the topic. And interestingly, those that actually are the experts underestimate their abilities.
Yes. Yes, definitely.
And it's having a real effect on society in the age of AI.
Yes. Yes.
Just a little bit. Just a little bit. Yeah. No, it's something that's been studied extensively. And it's one of the things I use it when I advise high school students. You know, when your teacher says you're good at something, believe them.
Yes.
Because you don't necessarily understand that. And I didn't have that recognition until much later in life. But if you know how to tie a shoe, mm-hmm. understanding that it's exceptionally difficult for someone else mm-hmm. is almost impossible to imagine, because you're like, but wait. This is really easy. What do you mean you don't know? And I had the weird experience when I had that exact experience, but it was regarding linear algebra in college.
Okay.
Amongst all the fellow math majors.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, oh, you didn't think that test was easy? And you found out the entire class bombed it. And you're like, but I thought you were all great in math. You're all math majors. Oops. But it's hard. You don't recognize your own ability because why would you? It's easy.
Right.
If something is truly easy, you have no reason to believe that it's not that way for everyone. But the danger comes in with AI is that when people don't know anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're playing with AI.
Yeah.
And it just builds upon that overconfidence because AI will hallucinate.
Just a little bit. Okay, a lot. It does a lot.
And it will make things up, and it likes to please the user.
Yes, yes.
It really likes to please the user. Oh, it loves to please the user. And yeah, so it's really interesting what goes on. And there's been a number of research on it that says when life or death is on the line, the more scary the results, the more exasperated it becomes.
Okay. Yeah.
More exaggerated. So the people who don't know are more likely to be more confident in their decisions that they're making, and AI will make them even more confident in their decisions that completely lack context, knowledge, or basis for making the decision. Uh-huh. This is something that has been researched for long before most of society has been playing with generative AI.
Yes, yes.
A very common known effect.
Well, when did they study Dunning-Kruger? Wasn't that in like the late 90s?
Yes, I believe it was in 99 was when they published their findings.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's been a while. Yeah.
And there's a lot of scientific research on it. So when you hear about people falling into an AI hole, or you see executives making decisions, right? Have you ever used a piece of software where the AI was so confident it gave you the right answer?
I don't trust AI. Yeah, I mean that's where I sit.
But the companies trust the AI.
Yes. Yes.
As a customer, you go to the AI and you're saying, okay, I'm trying to accomplish this. Given your product and my current licensing status, can I do this?
And AI will say,
give you complete directions, none of which you can actually do with your current licensing status on that tool.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And you're saying, but over here, you said this, and it'll be very confident. But it's even scarier is when it does it with the users of AI. And so people make decisions that affect maybe layoffs.
Sure, sure. Or your purchasing decisions or your whatever it is. People are using AI to determine what they should do about retirement. Instead of going to, let's say, a retirement professional, you know, some kind of financial planner. And I've been hearing some horror stories about that.
Oh, no. Yeah, no, I actually had a friend that their business, for a number of reasons, kind of took a turn, and so they needed to pivot. And so they were working with AI to redefine what they were going to be doing. Right. Sounds generally good. Except they never wanted any human contact. They were strictly having this conversation with the AI.
Yeah.
And this went on for a number of months. In the meantime, I began concerned because I know about people falling into, what do you call it? Kind of like a hole?
With AI, where they
almost like that's all they believe and see, and almost like
so the AI, the AI was doing like cult like behavior. Is that what you're saying? You can't talk to any of your friends. You can't talk to anybody. You have to trust me.
Yeah, and it was really helping building its confidence. Right, they were building their confidence on their ideas.
Sure.
And the interesting thing came about when you would ask questions.
Yes.
From the perspective of reality.
Yes, yes.
About these plans, the human being would get really offended. But the interesting thing is the human being would take what happened back to the AI.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, the AI literally said that they shouldn't be friends because I didn't believe in their ideas.
That is a whole level of creepy that I don't even know how to unpack.
Yeah. I think they even fed a transcript unbeknownst to us about a conversation we had to the AI.
Yeah.
To help them understand, because they didn't understand the questions that they were asking, very poignant, according to something they said they were going to now do as a business, which is nothing related to anything they've been doing. But it is happened to be related to things I've been doing for 30 years.
Oh, wow. This is yikes. Okay. I don't even know how to process that. That's scary.
No.
So
I would say watch out for your friends if they're only workshopping ideas strictly with AI.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree totally.
Keep the humans in the loop.
This is an area where we definitely need to watch out. We need to be very careful on that. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And Dr. Doreen Galley.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. MicroCenter is where tomorrow's tech meets today's hands-on excitement. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I've been shopping Micro Center for years because they always have what's next. Whether you're building a custom desktop, upgrading your laptop, or diving into smart home automation, Micro Center has the gear, the guidance, and the grit to get you there. From high-performance laptops and ultra-fast storage to 3D printers, robotics kits, and pro-grade monitors, it's all under one roof. Need help? Their in-store experts speak your language, whether that's HDMI, USB-C, or I just want it to work. With over 20 locations nationwide and microcenter.com open 24/7, you're never far from your next breakthrough. Whether you're a weekend tinkerer, a creative pro, or just tech curious, Microcenter is your launchpad. Visit microcenter.com today. That's Microcenter, built for what's next. Microcenter.com. The website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. Reach out with your computer questions, your technology concerns. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will get back to you with answers to your computer questions and, yes, your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Marcus asks, why do some companies still run their own data centers instead of going fully cloud? And I'm in a company that actually does both, and some companies are definitely running their own data centers, and some are definitely going fully cloud, and some of this can be done in both locations. Cloud does feel like the heart of modern IT strategy. It feels like a default these days because it's flexible, it's scalable, it's pay as you go. But there are different companies out there that may prefer to stick with racks of servers humming away in a private building. And the reason for this in either direction isn't about stubbornness or nostalgia. On one end, it definitely is everything I've mentioned so far, the flexibility, the scalability, and so forth. But some companies like the control, the cost, the compliance, and the reality that not every workload fits neatly into the other model, the cloud model or the on-site model. And along the way, there are trade-offs. And the decision to keep a data center running starts to make a lot of sense for some companies. Companies keep their own data centers because of the idea of wanting to know about the security and the exact way that their systems behave. And they choose that control over the performance. And this is, I came out of the aerospace industry. The cost for maintaining ITAR and ear compliance with your servers is a lot more. They have to hire very special people. They can't utilize any offshore items. In the financial world, it goes in a different direction. And sometimes those workloads demand that only certain people have access. Okay. And other workloads may demand extremely low latency. We go into that finance world and some of the scientific computing that doesn't require that Americans only have access. And that starts to really develop a balance. Some of these different fields require that high-speed response. It's measured in microseconds, not milliseconds. Running on premises gives companies predictable performance. There is no shared infrastructure, no noisy neighbors, no surprise slowdowns. And certain industries, defense industry, the energy industry, healthcare, there are all of these different strict requirements. And those necessitate the physical access, the network paths, the hardware configurations. And some organizations have various other intellectual property, regulated data that they don't want leaving their walls. And for companies with highly customized systems, it's worked like this. We built our infrastructure to behave in very specific ways. All of that cloud promise can feel more like a compromise. Moving it could break things that have worked reliably for years. Now, cost is usually the big selling factor for going to the cloud, but cloud isn't always cheaper, especially if you have certain performance issues that are going on. If you've got large, steady workloads, and cloud pricing is built around bursting workloads. You've got high workloads during certain hours. They scale up and down. But if you're running 24/7 at high capacity, the cloud can be more expensive than owning the hardware yourself. We also have companies that have invested all kinds of energy and effort and money and time, millions of dollars into these data centers and cooling systems and networking gear, and they will want to get full value out of those assets before they decide to move on. And they may consider that we've put all of this into this direction. Moving out of this at this point just doesn't make sense, and it may never make any kind of real sense to do that. And when we get into these organizations, they manage to negotiate various bulk hardware deals and support deals and a number of other things where, you know, you can go. You want to buy 20 Dell servers, for instance, and you want all of the replacement hardware to be out to you in 4 hours. You can pay for that. And a technician on site to replace that hard drive or replace that motherboard or replace whatever, you can pay for that. And that becomes a very distinct direction. And when you've got a large volume of this, what happens is Dell says, yeah, we can do that and we'll give you a discount. And this whole on-premises infrastructure actually becomes far more cost effective. We also have an issue where cloud costs can become unpredictable. You've got all of the data ingress and egress fees. You've got storage growth and scaling events, which can actually move you past what you had budgeted for. And companies, they typically want to maintain control over this. The unpredictability of all of these different expenses that come along with cloud can throw things off. Whereas it's far more predictable to own hardware with fixed depreciation schedules. And that can actually be easier to manage than the cloud bill, which can be a matter of a few thousand 1 month and 10,000, 20,000 the next month. And the big reason that I look at, that I see that companies staying on premises, is that migrations are hard, technically, operationally, and culturally. If you've got a bunch of legacy systems, they weren't designed for the cloud. They rely on local networks, specific hardware, or tightly coupled components that don't translate well to the cloud architectures. Rewriting or re-architecting some of these systems can take years. And during that time, the business needs to operate with zero disruption. We also have issues where licensing models for applications, they may not work well in the cloud. Moving them could trigger expensive renegotiations. Also, we have an issue where large organizations, which would possibly benefit from a portion of items being on the cloud, they also have a slow-moving infrastructure because they've got complex approval processes. Oh, we've got a bunch of people that have to sign off on this. We have a bunch of different risk assessments we have to do. We have compliance checks that can actually slow down a lot of this cloud adoption. And then sometimes the people who built and maintain the existing systems are more comfortable with what they know, those on-premises environments. Changing tools and the workflows and the responsibilities can turn into something that is far more of a major cultural shift. And culture these days in companies is actually being seen as far more valuable than it has been in a long time. Marcus's question here is a reminder that the cloud isn't a magic wand. It isn't the solution for everyone. It isn't going to be the solution for most people. It is simply one tool in a tool chest. And like any tool, it may not always be the right fit for every job out there. For some companies, the best solution is a hybrid approach where you keep the critical, sensitive, and high-performance workloads on premises and move the other things off to the cloud. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Hey guys, this is Benny Rockwell. Most of us use video cameras nowadays, but what about those old movie films in the back of your closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. Imagine Grandpa's old 8mm and 16mm films that are just sitting in a box getting old and fading away. Legacy Digital will clean and recondition those films, capture them digitally frame by frame, and then produce beautiful DVDs of your precious memories on long-lasting archive-quality discs. They don't use a projector, and your films can't be damaged in the process, the best available for families like yours. The final results are gorgeous. What better way to preserve those precious memories for future generations? Call right now, mention my name, Benny Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY, 1-866-253-4229. And tell them Benny sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, IT professionals, and some of the secrets that we know. And technology behaves differently under calm conditions and completely differently when the pressure rises. A system that may feel smooth and predictable on a normal day can stumble when the moment arrives that demand has spiked, and that shift often surprises people. This happens because most systems are designed around typical use, not peak usage. They run comfortably within their limits until something pushes them beyond what they handle easily. The change may feel sudden, even though the limits were always there. I want you to picture this. You're driving down the highway, and this is a car that you've always driven down the highway at 60, 70 miles an hour, whatever the speed limit is. And we'll just say you're driving a Toyota Corolla. I don't even know if they make Corollas anymore. It doesn't matter. The key issue is you're driving it, the speed limit, you're going 60, 70 miles an hour. If all of a sudden you start driving that every day at 120 miles an hour, you have pushed the limits of what that car can do. You are right at the edge, and you're also at the right at the edge of what your human limits are, what other people's limits are, and all of this. And everything just goes really bad from there. Let me translate that into techno items. We think about our home internet. Streaming a movie works fine for most evenings, but the second that you have these multiple devices all trying to stream these high-resolution movies, and somebody takes in a video call, and somebody's doing gaming online, and all of these different things start packing into your pipe out to the internet, everything slows down. The network. Your home network didn't break. Your internet actually didn't break. You just arrived at a level of demand that your network normally doesn't see. And we see this across the board. Everyday apps behave this way. You've got a budgeting app that loads instantly at the start of the month, and it might lag on the first business day when thousands of people across the company all log in at once. And this might not be budgeting. This might be timesheets. This might be the ERP software. This might be whatever it is. All of a sudden, at the beginning of the day, we see across the board a lot of different systems will spike up in user volume. That's because everybody gets in at 8 o'clock, for instance. And at 8 o'clock, everybody's logging in, so there's a lot of pressure there. The pressure exposes bottlenecks. And systems will reveal their true character when they're stressed. And in the workplace, this is very visible. A database that performs well during routine hours can struggle whenever we see a product launch. We can see this whenever there's a reporting deadline. The level of workload changes and the system itself starts to show where it's thin. And we see this everywhere throughout. We can see this in customer service platforms. They'll behave the same way. They run smoothly until a surge of calls or messages come in. And then these small delays turn into long queues. And the pressure magnifies every inefficiency that's across the system. Even beyond the computers itself, it starts to measure inefficiency with the people who are using the computers because they don't know what to do. They panic, and that slows down the calls, and it starts to have those further impacts. Hardware also responds differently under stress. A laptop that seems fast during casual browsing can actually overheat whenever we're doing something like a long video meeting and other high-intensity items that we might do with a laptop. And the device isn't failing. It is reacting to the excessive load that's being placed upon it. And whenever people are under pressure, you know, the systems go under pressure. Now everybody, all of the people are under pressure. These failures in the system actually will feel worse. A slow login during a relaxed moment is annoying. A slow login during a point where you're about ready to start a presentation, that feels catastrophic. So these different layers of pressure expose weaknesses that were always present, but not actually visible. Now, one of the things that IT pros do, we go forward, we help by designing systems with what's called headroom, that little extra capacity that gives technology room to breathe when demand spikes, preventing these small issues from becoming big, huge ones. And we put in monitoring tools, and this makes a difference as well. We can see how the systems behave under these different loads. We can predict where problems are going to appear before users feel those problems. And real-world comparisons can also come into play. A car drives differently uphill rather than on flat ground. A kitchen works differently during a dinner rush than on a quiet afternoon. And technology follows these same rules. And when systems do fail under pressure, the goal here is clear communication. And that will help everyone stay calm. If we spread the word that the issue is load-related and not catastrophic, that helps everyone to reduce their stress. And for the IT professional, it's good because it builds trust. The IT crowd is on top of things. We're working through the situation, and we are seeking to handle this gracefully. We're not going to eliminate pressure, but we can really look to see that things will work out in the end. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and, well, a normal person. Recently, though, it became clear to me that it was time to upgrade. I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After looking for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their care, their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when all I needed was a 1-gallon bucket. The folks at SiteGround know WordPress, Joomla, and more. SiteGround ground.com, S-I-T-E, ground.com, for your web hosting needs. SiteGround. Shane's question. My computer keeps asking me to restart for updates, but I'm in the middle of work. How long can I safely delay it? 5 minutes. That's it. No, I'm only kidding. When your computer asks for a restart, it means that the update is already downloaded and it's waiting to install. Your computer system can't apply certain fixes while everything is running, so it pauses until you give it the green light. We used to wind up with it just doing it. All of a sudden, your system's shutting down. You're going, what's going on? Nothing breaks if you wait. It does stay in a holding pattern. And most updates fall into two categories. It's feature updates and security patches. Feature updates, it doesn't matter. They can wait without much consequence. Security patches, however, they matter more because they're closing the holes that the bad guys, the attackers, actively look for. The restart of your system is what locks those fixes into place. Delaying the restart doesn't undo the download. It doesn't set anything back, but it does leave your system running with old code. And that's why these reminders keep popping up. The computer wants to finish the job of installing the updates. Now, most systems aren't forcing a restart immediately unless there's a critical emergency patch. These are really growing rare, and when they happen, the computer is giving you clear warnings before taking action. So this restart request, it isn't a crisis situation usually. It's your computer just saying, I'm ready to finish the update whenever you are. So for everyday updates, you can safely wait until, I would say, the end of the day without any real risk. The system is designed to accommodate your schedule. It's only when you start to postpone and weeks later, and that's when you start really drifting, you're full steam into unsafe territory. Security patches deserve more urgency because attackers, when they find out about these patches, they go through, they process them, they evaluate them, and they look for what the vulnerability is being patched, and they look to leverage it. So restarting at the end of the day keeps you ahead of that curve. It's a small habit that pays off in really big protection. So in the workplace, ITs are scheduling restarts during off hours to avoid interrupting people. You can sometimes it might be a 2-hour delay, but you can borrow that approach by choosing a time when you're done for the day. The update installs cleanly and you just start fresh the next morning. If you want, you can do that at lunchtime too. Across society, computers are getting better at handling all of these updates in the background. But that final restart is that moment when everything just locks into place. It's all good there. You skip it too long, and it leaves you running on outdated parts of the software. And that restart is just simply tightening that last bolt. The update isn't complete until that moment. When you choose a reasonable window, you are going to stay protected without letting these updates interrupt your very important workflow. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. We'll catch you next week.
Coming up next is a really funny guy. You all know him. Let's give it up for Alonzo Bowden. Alonzo!
So my uncle calls and he says he's dizzy and he's losing his balance. I'm like, Unc, you want me to take you to a doctor? He's like, no, I'm going to look up the symptoms. I said, your symptoms are you're dizzy and you're losing your balance. So he said, I can't get on the internet because my arm is numb. I said, well, use your good arm and dial 911. Stroke's no joke. If you or someone you love is showing symptoms of stroke, don't call family. Don't dial a friend. Don't wait, because it might be too late. Dial 911. Time lost is brain lost. Seriously, dial 911.
Learn all the symptoms of a stroke at strokesnojoke.org. That's strokesnojoke.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.